This is what I've seen in the 4 weeks since infection. People killing people. Which is much what I saw in the 4 weeks before infection and the 4 weeks before that and before that, as far back as I care to remember, people killing people. Which to my mind puts us in a state of normality right now.
Another episode.
That's not cool.
There's nothing cool. I was gonna do this whole, and it's not cool at all, is it?
You tried.
Yeah. I think I forgot what episode it was, and so there was nothing cool about what I was gonna
do. With all the voices you do.
I know, and I was gonna do. I was gonna do my Count Dracula something or other, and it didn't pan out. God damn it! Anyway, it's a damn podcast. I'm Adam Sherlock.
I'm Adam Poulter.
Episode 28?
28.
28! 28 days later!
Oh, that works out
I didn't
nicely.
Even fucking think about that! Yeah!
Talk about just
shit!
Beautiful coincidence.
Yeah, alright, so welcome to the second installment of our Halloween horror movie fest. Last week, we did the classic haunted house movie, The Changeling, starring George C. Scott, who was in Malice, with Nicole Kidman, and then you knew it from here. What was it?
She was in The Interpreter with Sean Penn, who was in State of Grace with Gary Oldman, who was in Batman Begins with Cillian Murphy.
Who is in this week's movie, 28 Days Later.
Now, before we start, I must say, I recently just rewatched State of Grace.
Yeah?
You have to see that movie.
Okay.
It is...
Really?
It is why The Departed is made. It is almost
really?
As good, if not better, than The Departed.
Whoa, it
is,
really?
It is unbelievable.
Now, what's that one all about? I don't even know if I know.
Irish mob, so that's why I compare it to The Departed. But the acting and Gary Oldman, probably his best performance I've ever seen. It's unbelievable. It really is.
Like, really, really, like, the best.
If you see this,
this is better than Drexel the Pimp.
It's up there, if not better.
Okay.
I would say it's up there, if not better. It is unreal.
Like, really?
And this is such an underrated movie, I just don't get why it's not more popular.
State of Grace.
Unbelievable.
It's when did it come out?
Sean Penn, Robin Wright, John C. Reilly is in it.
I don't know what it is about that title that made me forget it so quick. There's like something about that title that seems a little...
There's tons of people in it, but he plays an unbelievable character. I won't get into it too much,
but it's a really good movie.
Fucking amazing. So
Gary Oldman, you really can't go wrong with Gary Oldman. No. Gary Oldman isn't in this week's movie.
No, I'm sorry.
But Cillian Murphy is. It's 28 Days Later. Danny Boyle, who you know from Trainspotting, The Beach, which I think is a very underrated movie.
I do too.
I like it.
I really like that movie too. It's got some weak parts. But
it has some weak parts, but it's got some fucking great stuff in it.
So good.
It's a really good one that I think just kind of...
Sunshine.
Millions.
I
never saw that.
Oh, it's kind of the kids' movie.
Oh, great. Okay. That's great Danny Boyle.
Yeah.
Now, once again, terrific. Danny Boyle didn't, to make
Shallow
this
Grave
movie,
was another one.
Shallow Grave. I love Shallow Grave. Ewan McGregor, right?
Yep. And two people I don't know.
Now, isn't the guy who played Bixby, and it's also in 28 Weeks Later, he has a role in Shallow Grave, I believe.
Because
I think him and what I know about it is that him and Danny Boyle are actually friends. That's why he agreed to do 28 Weeks Later, which isn't a bad movie, but it's not really that good.
I figured this would probably come up, but I know you think it kind of missed the mark on it. I guess, and with a lot of movies, my expectations were pretty low, so I was just kind of like, well, you know, I love the first one, I guess I'll watch it. And this is like 2 years after it came out, so I really enjoyed it. Like,
really?
From scene one, the opening scene, I was like, oh, shit, because they really...
No, that first scene's great.
It's pretty intense. There's definitely parts like when Michael from Lost chops him up with the helicopter. There's definitely some weird stuff, but I guess I was wondering how they were going to keep the story going and keep me interested. And
I liked the plot. I liked the story. I just, where it went, I didn't like. What I had to say about it is if 28 Days Later was a TV series and that was the first episode of the second season, it'd be phenomenal. But as a movie on its own merit and to use it as the sequel to this movie, it misses the mark in my book. And I think one of the reasons why is that it isn't a bad movie, but it's such a testament to how much I love 28 Days Later, mm-hmm. because I think that it truly is a rethinking of the zombie movie. And, you know, I wanted to say this first of all. I want to get this out of the way because this might be a little over the top, but zombie movies have always really frightened me. Not necessarily like that they're walking towards you and you've got to go inside an abandoned house and board it up. It's not that. There was something deeper about it that really frightened me, and I couldn't really put my finger on what it was. And I was reading on the internet a couple days ago about this Freudian idea that's called the uncanny. And mm-hmm. I don't know if you know what that is.
Doesn't sound familiar.
Okay, well, I found a really old kind of cheesy recording that kind of explains what it is. Okay. So just, the sound quality is bad and there's some stupid music to it, but just listen to it and it'll kind of explain what I'm getting at. So hold on one second.
The uncanny is a Freudian concept of an instance where something can be familiar yet foreign at the same time, resulting in a feeling of it being uncomfortably strange. Because the uncanny is familiar yet strange, it often creates cognitive dissonance within the experiencing subject due to the paradoxical nature of being attracted to yet repulsed by an object at the same time. This cognitive dissonance often leads to an outright rejection of the object, as one would rather reject than rationalize. The state is first identified by Ernst Jentsch in a 1906 essay on the psychology of the uncanny. Jentsch defines the uncanny as doubts whether an apparently animate being is really alive, or conversely, whether a lifeless object might be, in fact, animate.
So basically what it's saying is the idea that, okay, if you're in the supermarket behind a guy in line and he reaches for a magazine and you suddenly realize that he has a fake hand, right? Yeah. And you do that little, like, for a half a second because it's like, yeah. it seems like a hand, but then it isn't a hand.
Yeah.
Right? Like, okay, that times 1,000 is kind of what they're talking about. And the idea of, okay, the department store mannequin that for a second you think is a person and you're like, yeah, right? And then it isn't. It's a fucking mannequin. Now times that by 1,000, and that's what the zombie movie is, right? Because mm-hmm. a lot of times it's your friends, it's your neighbors. If suddenly right now the dead were to come to life or whatever, they'd be the people like on my street that I know and that I see every day. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that, and I know it doesn't affect everybody because like my wife hates zombie movies and she could give a fuck. For me, there's something about that inherent idea of the uncanny, of this thing that's supposed to be familiar, and instead it is not. It's something that's dead, or it's something that's trying to attack you. That is fucking terrifying to me.
Are we supposed to think that that's not you on the recording?
I don't know. I found it. The DI. Uh-huh.
You're not fooling it.
On an old piece of vinyl. I don't know what you're talking about. Uh-huh. Anyway, okay. So leave that be. That's neither here nor there. Okay. So, and I think that this is a new version of that same idea. And, you know, he uses some things about it where they're not technically zombies in the fact that they aren't dead and have come back to life. Yeah. But I think that that's the cool infected. Thing about it. Yeah, they're infected, right? Yeah. Once again, we say this every time. If you haven't seen 28 Days Later, go see it. Da-da-da-da-da. We're going to talk about it as if you just watched it with us.
Now, this was a movie that got a lot of... It was a year that I did go to Sundance, and there was a lot of hype behind it. A lot of people saying, it's the scariest movie you've ever seen!
Ever made!
And all this stuff. So there's tons of hype, and people I know saw it, and they're like, oh my god, this movie, blah, 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 and all this stuff. And I ended up seeing it when it came out in the theater, and I don't remember being scared once in the theater. There may have been one point where I jumped, but...
That was it. Really?
And so I think it's another thing with those with expectations where you expect too much, and then it's just like, I mean, it was cool, but I was expecting to be, you know, pissing myself.
Right.
I'm so scared. But on repeated watchings, this movie is truly a masterpiece. It really is everything you want in a zombie movie, and it's really its own original thing.
It really is.
And I love how it's really grainy. It looks like a 70s movie. Danny Boyle shot it all with a
digital camera,
right? And I guess is part of the reason why he was able to get get those great, like, you know, Omega Man type shots where they're in London in the middle of nowhere and everything's just destroyed.
Oh my God, man,
because they don't have to spend a half an hour getting the reels ready and all that stuff. They can basically say, okay, we're ready.
Hold the traffic.
Hit record.
Yeah, hit record.
So it takes them, you know, 10 minutes to get six cameras set up.
And something about
that makes
digital,
a lot of sense.
Something about digital cameras, you know, that scene right towards the beginning when he very first encounters the infected and he doesn't know what they are.
Yeah, in the church.
Yeah, and then after that, the other two survivors, I can't remember what the guy's name in it is supposed to be, but him and Selena save him and throw the fire bombs at them, and it ends up blowing up that entire gas station.
Okay. Yeah.
If it had been regular film, which I have nothing against, I love the way that true film looks, but if it had been that, it wouldn't have looked as beautiful as it does. Well, there's something about it, like, almost pixelating in those scenes of the guys on fire running into the gas station.
Well, I think it says
it's almost beautiful.
Says a lot about technology, though, and you don't need to have that, you know? You can do this with six little handheld cameras and have it look amazing.
Incredible!
And I think one part that added a lot to it was that it kind of made you kind of on the run with them, because it is kind of handheld, but you got to give a lot of credit to Boyle, and he just really, especially since Trainspotting on, I think is really has his own style.
Right.
And, you know, especially if you watch, you know, stuff like Sunshine or The Beach, mm-hmm. They really have just a distinct style that nobody else really has or can copy, and especially in Millions, he does some incredible camera work.
Really?
And it's really like, it's kind of a family movie, but terrific.
It really
is terrific.
I'm gonna have to check it out because I'm a huge fan of him. You know, let's kind of go through some of the scenes that really makes this such a memorable movie. I think that, you know, the very introduction where we have
the monkeys
is really well done, and you know, I kind of like the subtext of you know, the Animal Liberation Front is the one who creates the end of the world.
For sure, yeah.
Like, there's something kind of good about that. But, you know, I think that it's a very fucked up, gnarly first scene for a movie, and it's done really well. And the next scene that we get after that is Cillian Murphy, like, laying in the bed, waking up from the coma, and it is full frontal nudity. We're about a minute and a half in. The thing that's cool about that, of them doing that scene, is it just kind of shows that, like, we're not going to pull any punches.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, yep, that's his balls. I don't know. Something about that. I mean, I'm joking, but at the same time, there's something about it that just makes you go, wow, okay, well, it's going to be as realistic as it can get,
for sure.
Know, in this context.
I loved how they had the kind of end of the world Armageddon news footage playing on the TVs for the monkeys. So, of course, but like, if they're already irate, why would you have that on TV?
Like that, we're going to use that to show them. The other thing I think is great is when Cillian, something I noticed this time I don't think I ever had before, this movie is full of little nuances, little touches that makes it its own thing. One of them I think that I had never noticed before is that once Cillian Murphy wakes up, you know, and he has no idea where he is, and he realizes he's in a hospital room, and he seems to remember that he had been in a crash.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a key tossed under his door.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
It gives you this context of that, you know, while someone was ringing. It made me think of, the hospitals when Katrina hit,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that some of the people, doctors and nurses after Katrina have been tried for murder because they euthanized a bunch of the patients that they couldn't move. And there was something about that. It reminded me of that somebody was throwing the keys, you know, for these rooms under the doors
because they couldn't help them.
And so they locked the doors, threw the key under it, and ran off, hoping maybe if this person wakes up, like, there'll be a future for them. You know, like, it just gives you this great foreshadowing of the events that happened, and like, you know, the piles of soda cans on the ground, and the phones,
the
and none of them work.
On the stairs.
Yeah, the piles of money.
I liked first too, at least through the first half of the movie, you basically kind of get that they all think there's no government, this is worldwide.
Yeah.
You know, but it, obviously that changes, especially with 28 weeks later, where there's obviously a government.
Right, right, right.
Just
right,
being
right.
quarantined, but near the end of the movie here, they're saying there's no way it could cross oceans and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I really liked how, you know, at first you're kind of with them, but then it kind of makes sense. And I think that was something I read where that was kind of a script change in the middle of the movie kind of deal.
And then they decided that there was something else. Well, yeah, we'll get to that in a minute.
It's a question, but...
You know, the Godspeed You Black Emperor song.
I was going to ask you, is that when he's kind of walking around?
Yes.
I was wondering if that's who it was or if it was Mogwai. I thought it was one of them.
It is Godspeed You Black Emperor, and it basically took... Yeah, it basically took Danny Boyle begging that band because they are very anti-Hollywood.
One of my all-time favorite bands.
Same here. You know, and they're very anti-commercial, and so they had to sign a deal where he could use the song in the movie, but not on the soundtrack.
I looked mm-hmm. today, and I was like, it's got to be on there. Like, yeah. Is that Mogwai? Because it was very familiar, but mm-hmm. I totally
it's
makes sense.
It's such a great, like, yeah, has this, like, churning kind of, like, expectation to it, and then you get the car alarm that goes off, you know, and... You know, this movie, the majority of this movie was filmed before 9/11,
yep.
And the wall of the missing flyers is like a very creepy premonition, though, because that's exactly, you know what I mean? There was
sure.
there were
I'm sure
thousands
got,
of those.
I'm sure you got criticism for it.
Yeah, and it's like, I did it before that. It has nothing. Sorry. And there's that great one where, like, it's going across and showing all of them. There's a child's drawing. It has, like, mommy and daddy in the house, and daddy's, like, standing there and looks all crazy. Mommy's in pieces on the floor.
Speaking of mommy and daddy, the scene where he goes back to his house.
Oh, my God.
It's so heartbreaking.
It really is.
When
that
he goes
is,
into the. In his
yeah, what is
room
the
and,
note?
That's the part that gets you.
Now we're sleeping with you. Please don't wake up.
Oh, well, that's the part that gets you because they're holding
yeah.
a picture of him.
Yeah.
And they wrote
it's written
like,
on the back.
Wow,
yeah.
That's
it's
really
so,
heartbreaking.
It's so rough.
Gosh, I'm trying to think.
The way that Selena just kills Mark is the guy, the other guy's name that she's with.
Oh, yeah.
Where he has the cut and he's like, no, wait, it's okay. And she just hacks him to
yep.
pieces right there.
It's pretty
and, like,
ruthless.
This, yeah, and you barely know her character and you're just like, what the fuck, man? Like,
for sure. Well, I mean, she basically explains too, you have about 10 to 15 seconds to kill that person or you're going to be dead.
Yeah.
That's
and says that,
the ultimatum,
you know, he didn't know he was infected. And she said, well, no, he did know. I could see it in his eyes.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think that starts when they start talking about that really starts the conversation that's at the heart of this movie. And I think, you know, I talked about before one of the big ideas, at least for me, I believe, of behind the idea of zombie movies of, like I said, the uncanny, the thing coming back at you that looks similar to maybe a loved one or someone you knew, but now it's different. That is the first frightening part of zombie movies. The second half of it is, I think, that zombie movies at their whole are really disaster movies, right? Mm-hmm. Like Towering Inferno or fucking Deep Impact or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, they're movies about the end of the world. And so the main theme and question that keeps coming up is, what is more important, the human soul and the human spirit, or survival?
Now, there's two movies that this reminds me of, or I should say, have similar themes along what not normal zombie movies do, like you said, end of the world type stuff. I think part of it is too because the background is such a big part of this, mm-hmm. is Children of Men.
Definitely, I would completely agree
with
that.
There's aspects of just... No, it's more about the adventure of these people than why it ended or
right,
whatever.
Right.
Though you do get more of an understanding why everyone's infected as opposed to Children of Men where you
where
don't
just
really
sort of
get
happened
an answer.
And
you're
not there
and,
to see it.
And then this is more in the theme towards the end of the movie with the general and stuff, but Apocalypse Now, where they you know, basically finally get out of this hell to go into another hell where there's this not as crazy as,
as maybe
Marlon Brando's character
right.
in Apocalypse Now, but it's kind of the same crazy in the way that he's got...
There are no rules.
Yeah, and he's gotten to a point where he knows what he'll accept and what he won't. Like, when he offers
exactly.
up the women and
yeah,
stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just got a hint of Apocalypse
no,
Now.
No, I could see that. I could definitely see that. So, and I think that, you know, I think you're absolutely right, and I think that that's... you know, really at the heart of these of zombie movies in general, but this movie in particular is the idea of it is the end of the world and you are going to be hardened because of these events, but you still have a choice. What are you going to do? And that Cillian Murphy is saying, his character of Jim is saying, I won't do these things. Like, I want to be a human still. I want to not be hardened like this. And Selena, and what's the actress's name? Do you
I don't know. Yeah.
She's hot, though.
Yeah, she's...
She's really cute.
She's doing well for herself.
But she, you know, she's saying, you're naive, you don't understand yet. And I think that that's a really... That narrative occurs through the rest of the movie. Now we enter the second phase of the movie, where the two of them meet
Brendan Gleeson. Who is...
Can I say right now... I would totally want Brendan Gleeson by my side if it was the end of the world.
Yeah.
There's something about him that just makes you want to, like, cuddle up under his arm and be like, tell me it's going to be okay.
And I forgot he was in this. And he really...
Amazing.
Is unbelievable. Amazing. He really is just... He holds his own in such a unique way.
Well, and his character is still just so... I mean, his character embodies what Cillian Murphy's character is talking about keeping your heart, keeping your empathy, keeping your soul... I mean, even that great scene where they go to the grocery store.
Yeah.
You know, and that's such a fun scene, and it's so great where he makes
kind of weird to have a fun scene in the middle of all this porn.
He makes him put the bottle back, the bottle of whiskey back. He's like, you can't just take anything.
Yeah,
he's
like,
this is a double malt. It's aged. It's, you know, and he grabs a couple bottles. And then the next scene is the heart of the entire movie about... As far as that argument goes, as far as that diatribe of what is more important, that when they all leave the grocery store, Brendan Gleeson puts his credit card down.
Yeah.
On the register.
Mm-hmm.
And it is this idea of just like, just in case. You know what I mean? It's just, it's keeping that humanity.
Key.
Yeah, it's like
the key.
Yeah, we don't need anarchy. This is, you know, we still have to be this way. And everything that follows after that, them at the ruins and watching the horses and talking about they're doing just fine.
The editing in this movie is really pretty unbelievable. There's lots of really quick edits that I think really flow really well. I just want to hit on a few key Danny Boyle moments, at least for me anyways. And it's all cinematography here for me as far as the little nuances that we've talked about and stuff. Some of the scenes where they have the scan of the city and you can see... I think it's Brandon Gleason's mouth up in the corner.
No, it's actually like Mark. It's the one guy who ends up, she ends up killing.
Exactly.
You just see the
corner
mouth.
Of it, and it just pans up to it. And I thought that was
really
that great.
Was incredible.
The lowered fish tank kind of thing where all the water's gone. One of my favorite shots is the water on the roof where they have all the buckets.
Oh, my God, all the collars up on the belt. Yeah, can I say one of mine?
Yeah.
The unclipped rose garden.
Oh yeah,
that they drive through, you know, and that was one scene that people were like, "Why did you add that?" And that was a weird psychedelic scene, and you know, all these different colors of the flowers as they're driving out of the town, and he said, "Well, it's not psychedelic. There's nothing. I mean, if you ask any, I guess I don't know what the technical term for it would be, but gardeners who specialize in these rose fields, which they do have lots of in England." You know, if you didn't keep those trimmed, that's what they would look like. It would be these just bursts of insane color because the roses, no one was there to care for them. So they just ran wild. And so that is what it would look like. But it's such a, like, shocking,
vibrant
color, you know, in this otherwise very dark and very gory and very violent movie. There's these bursts of those kinds of scenes. I think they're great. Do you have any others that you want to mention?
The only one I can think of, and a lot of these are just really quick, but it's stuff that's totally stuck out. The windmill shot where they're showing
the windmills. Isn't that one great?
I don't know. He's just got the style.
And it's got that really kind of cutesy, almost... who's the guy that did the music for Eternal Sunshine?
Beck?
No. The actual composer. He did I Heart Huckabees, too. I can't think of his name. It's on the tip of my tongue. Somebody write in and tell me what his name is. But the music almost sounds like that. It's this sort of like keyboards and like little drum machine kind of cutesy parts in it. And, you know, I have to say one of my favorite shots is Manchester Burning. where they finally pull up on Manchester and they can see it from the distance and the whole of the city is on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the car, yeah, and it pulls up so silly, but it's so much more realistic than if it was a Michael Bay,
yeah,
like, it's on fire! Totally. It's like, no, it's what it would really look
face.
Like,
yeah,
where you pull up and you see it from the freeway. And it's way off there, and there's just black smoke.
So great.
And you see a couple of big plumes of fire. It's just really intense.
Then they get to the...
The blockade. Where they've heard there is the cure for infection. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's right on the recording.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure his name is Major Henry West, the main guy who I was talking about earlier, who kind of is...
And I know I've seen him in so much stuff,
well,
but
and
I
this
can't
is what
think.
I was about to say, is I think... He's Ralph Fiennes Jr. because he looks exactly like him,
dude. It is. It's Ralph Fiennes and we were just talking about him. The new James Bond, fucking
Daniel Craig.
Daniel Craig. It's like if the two of them had a love child. That's what he would look
like. I just couldn't. I was like, that's like his brother or something.
Somebody.
So, but he does a great job. That whole scene, like I said, where.
That's really the third stage of the movie is mm-hmm. after Brendan Gleeson's character is
it's like the clip we played at the beginning is that's him talking
right
and I mean that really pans it out what his mentality is too
right
I think. Which I love how Cillian Murphy kind of ends up he has this whole sequence where it gets to a point in the end where it's not man versus zombie anymore. It becomes man versus man, you know?
It does. Well, and I think that the whole, there's a whole context of father figures in this too, where first we see Cillian Murphy's actual father figure,
mm-hmm.
and when we see him, he's dead, and we get a little bit of him in a flashback, but his parents are gone. And then he's just a kid, you know? He was a bike messenger before all this happened. It's not like he's some badass.
Yeah.
That happens, and then we have the Brendan Gleeson character where there is a definite father figure there for him.
Oh, yeah.
Even when he has his nightmare when they're staying out of the ruins, and he kind of wakes up from a little bit, and Brendan Gleeson says, don't worry about it, you're just having a nightmare. And he says, thanks, Dad. And goes back to sleep.
That's
and it's
right.
It's this really sweet little moment where you realize he needs that. And then after Brendan Gleeson's character is killed... We have
him meeting the
major.
The blood drip on the eye. I'm sorry.
That is well, just Brendan Gleeson's breakdown.
Oh, yeah.
And feeling like we really are out here in the middle of nowhere. What are we doing? And then they shoot him and kill him. And then we have the major and the two of them, him and the major and Cillian Murphy talking. And he says, "You're going to be okay." And he pats him on the back of the neck in this fatherly way, almost the way that Brendan Gleeson did earlier. I mean, it's almost. You know, it's almost the exact same maneuver, but this time, like, you feel the unease of, like, this isn't right. And, like, up until this point, Cillian Murphy's been really innocent and really been accepting what other people tell him to do. He's just accepting these people.
It kind of goes off on the Rutger Hauer Blade Runner ending scene where he's jumping off or climbing up walls. And
well, yeah, because and the part of that I like and that I really identify with is this end all idea of, well, if I'm going to die, either way,
yeah,
there is no future. We're done for, and these fucking douchebags are gonna rape the girl that mm-hmm. I've gotten to know. That's the only normal person I've met.
Yeah,
and. The little girl that I kind of think of as like a sister,
mm-hmm.
and they're throwing me
that's
out here to die anyway. I mean, it is that crack of like, I don't even fucking care. Well, I will kill whoever I have to kill. You know, I mean, it is that
where they really become divided too, as far as man versus man goes, because he's like, you know, I promised them I couldn't promise them a cure, but I had to promise them something. And so
this is the future.
Women is the what I had to promise
them.
Yeah,
that's the future that I have to promise
them.
And
just really, really powerful.
Well, and that great shot. I mean, well, and the sequence of events, and I absolutely love them. First, of him having this knowledge of, oh my God, that's why they didn't show up until after they had shot Brendan Gleeson. That's the first realization, and it never explains it, but you can almost just see it in Cillian Murphy's face. You can see that he's going, we got fucking set up. They saw that there were girls, and they waited, and they shot him, and now they've got me tied up in the fucking basement. And he's tied up with the other private, the other guy down there.
That's right.
Who wouldn't let them. He didn't, you know, he had a gun to all the other guys, like, you're not going to rape these girls. He's down there too. He tells Cillian Murphy, we were quarantined. This is bullshit. Everywhere else is fine. We're a little island. What do you think happened? Everybody else is doing fine.
Yeah.
And you kind of hear that and you go, no, that's bullshit, man. I've seen everything that's happened. It's bullshit. They take him out to shoot him. Cillian Murphy escapes. He's running through the forest, falls on the ground, and it's at that moment that he's like, I'm done for him. This is bullshit and the world is over. And then he looks up in the sky and he sees a plane flying by. That's right. And that is the most beautiful scene. And you just get it in his eye that he's like, these fucking assholes. There is a world out there. It's still civilized. I need to get these girls and find them, find this civilized world, because these guys are fucking nuts. And from that moment on, like you're saying, that man versus man, it's where it divides. And from that point on, I mean, he really, and you know, there's obviously the gimmicky end of it where it's like, you know, he's sort of like he's one of the infected, even though he's not. And there's the whole thing at the very end where he quips to her, like, that was longer than a heartbeat that you waited to kill me, even though he thought I was infected, da-da-da-da-da. But it makes sense and it works. And there's the great part where it starts raining and he's hiding in the back of the truck when they come after he's rang the alarm.
Yep.
And the camera just pans past him for a second and he looks like one of the infected. He's so fucking pissed. And he's going to kill every single one of them.
So
and from there on, like, there are just some gnarly scenes now, him just, like, rallying those fucking guys. Oh, man. It's incredible.
I love it.
Incredible.
And, of course, they get what's coming to them. You know?
Yeah, they really do, man. But I mean, I don't
What did you think of the very sympathy. End? Now, I know there's multiple alternate endings here. If you have the DVD
that I would say that, yes. And I would say this, first of all, very different than most zombie movie endings.
Yeah.
99% of zombie movies, dystopic ending, everybody dies. Or, we brought it on ourselves.
Or there's a kind of the comeback where, because you like Gavin said last week, you're never going to kill them all.
You know, right, exactly, yeah.
There's always, this one gives you hope at the end, like something's, you know, that they did find that outside world and there is happiness, you know, on top of a hill.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I didn't dislike it. It didn't seem fake to me. It seemed because I think that this movie, as far as from the zombie genre of movies, has much more heart and really delves into the idea of the human soul and the human spirit much more. I think most other zombie movies are about the scares and they are about
you're invested in the characters in this movie.
You're really invested in them.
And that's a huge difference.
You're really invested in them. And I won't stray away from the fact that I was really mad at Danny Boyle for a little while for killing off Brendan Gleeson.
Yeah.
Because his character in it is so strong and you like him so much. And maybe that was another problem I had with him, Bruges, is that you know what I mean? I hearkened back to that character and I was like, just let him live, for Christ's sake.
Well, the one of the alternate endings does have them, it doesn't go so far in the future, and it basically shows them trying to revive Cillian Murphy after he gets shot.
Right.
And he ends up dying.
Yeah. That is the dystopic ending where the two of them pick up guns and walk out the hallway. And that apparently, from what I've heard, is the true ending for it. But it didn't pan well with audiences, so they added this one.
I
kind of
like that, though.
I like this one. And God, man, the shot where first you see him get shot and they go to the hospital and they're trying to revive him and you get that really weird, this is another, probably the last really true Danny Boyle amazing scene. You get this blip shot of where they're living in that little house and everything upside down. I don't know if you know this, notice this. It's like a half a second shot of that valley with the house upside down with the hello, but the O isn't on there. It just says hell.
Yeah.
And it's upside down. It says hell for a second. And then you get, they're in this village and they're making this sign that says hello. But for a second, you just get that with the hell on it. And I remember the first time I watched it, I was like, what the fuck was that? And then you get everything that happens after it. But it's a great little piece of cinema. Just that, the way they did it. It was so cool.
Terrific.
Ending tidbits of things that you might want to mention?
That's pretty much all I
have. You know, a couple of small things. The tunnel scene with the rats running ahead. That's really great. I thought that was a great one.
True.
Another one that I really liked a lot was, it's a great scene that shows Cillian Murphy really realizing what he's up against, where they go to get gas and he goes inside the place and he has to kill the kid.
Yeah.
Part I don't get, why does he wander off? He's seen everything that's happened.
Yeah.
Why the fuck does he wander off by himself?
Doesn't tell anyone, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I can think is it's just sort of a fuck you to Selena, but it's still like, I don't get it. Like, why wander off, dude? Like, safety and fucking numbers, right? But
well, it's we'll probably get into that with the cliches, maybe.
It's a great movie. It's just beautiful to watch. I don't know. I don't have anything else to say about it.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and listen to a song by Dirt Bikes.
Yeah, the song is called "She Crawled Through the Wind." She crawled in through the window, I think, something like that. So when we come back, we will do top five zombie movie cliches. We'll be right back.
Bye.
Okay, welcome back to A Damn Podcast.
Yes.
From Salt Lake City. I'm Adam Pulcher.
And I'm Adam Sherlock.
We're going to continue the this zombie-centric episode with our top five zombie cliches.
Yes, yes. These are things that appear in the majority of zombie-related movies that you see.
Okay.
Usually. Usually.
All right. Do you want to start?
I'll go ahead and start. My number one.
Number one?
My number five.
Oh, okay.
My number one of the number five. What am I saying? Who cares?
You have five number ones?
I have five number ones.
Okay.
I do. Okay. My number five would be, it's always regular people's stories. It's never somebody who actually knows anything that's going on. It's always like, yeah, he's the gas station clerk, and now he's going to fight the zombies, or it's the fucking, right? It's like, she's a nurse, and now she has to fight zombies, you know? Or
yeah.
Or in 28 Days Later, he's a bicycle messenger, and now he has to fight zombies, right? I mean, isn't it always? It's never anybody, and they never encounter anyone that actually knows what's going on.
Yeah, I've got a couple that would probably tie in with that.
Well, why don't you go ahead and give me your number five?
Okay, my number five, this one's pretty obvious.
Okay.
It's in a lot of horror movies, but especially in zombie movies because you're being chased.
Okay.
But the car always dies or never starts in the first place.
Ever.
Ever.
Ever. Yeah, the car stalls.
Without a doubt, and the car stalls. Always. Always. Always.
And like, then it starts right when they're on the car.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, they're on the car.
They've got to get the scare in there. And then, okay.
Yeah, now I don't know. Yeah, it's horror. It's horror related alternators.
Yep.
Yeah, it's the only time that they. The rest of the movie, that car will start every goddamn time.
That's pretty much, you know, pretty.
Or it's always that, or the keys. Where are the keys? The keys are over there. Like we ran in the car, but man, I would keep. I do it anyway, right? I get up. I mean, maybe it's a smoker habit. I get up to walk out, and I go, keys lighter. Smokes, wallet, and okay, we're good. If I was in, like, you know, the end of the fucking world, you can bet your ass every 5 minutes I'd be like, keys, okay, keys, we're good.
Yeah.
But right, like, they get in the car and they're like, oh, the keys are on that guy and he's dead and he's being ripped apart by zombies over there every fucking time.
Yeah. That's a pretty obvious one, but go ahead with your number four.
My number four. The government always wants to understand the zombies, right? They're doing experiments. I always think of the original Dawn of the Dead with, I want to say that his name was, I couldn't look it up on the internet. I think his name was, did you ever see the original?
I don't think so.
In the original Dawn of the Dead, I think his name is Bud. Yeah. And he's like the zombie that they give like the headphones to, and like he's listening to music and like,
yeah.
And it's like they're like, all right, he's almost like a person. And it's like, no, he isn't. He's gonna eat your brain the first opportunity. 28 Days Later has the one too. His name starts with an M.
Oh,
Mitchell,
I got it.
Or
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah,
Mailer.
That was one of their guys, and they chain him up. And it's the same thing. It's like, in 28 Days Later, it's like, he's in your courtyard. Who cares if you have him on a chain? He's not a dog.
Yeah.
He is going to eat your brains eventually, the first chance that he gets. It will happen, and it does fucking happen.
Yep. He does let Mailer go.
Right? Yeah, yeah. He shoots the chain, and Mailer goes, and he goes on a rampage. But that's one of them, is the government always wants to understand the zombies. Like, nice. What is it about the zombies?
Good
like,
one.
Fucking every time.
Okay, my number four is, my number three and number four, kind of mixed together, but I'll do them separately here.
Okay.
Number four is killing a family member zombie. There's always a family member that eventually...
Ooh, that's one of mine.
Is it?
That's one of mine. Mine is, it's worded a little differently, but what it is is that someone that the rest of the characters care about, and that you, in turn, care about, becomes a zombie, and they're forced to kill them.
Yep.
Yeah, every time. That is, yes, down the line, one of the big cliches. Which I think works, though, because I think that it always pushes the storyline along and sort of shows you the sacrifices that the characters
have
to make.
And that's why it's always in there. Yeah.
But it is, I mean, seriously, Dawn of the Dead, it happens in Night of the Living Dead, the little girl becomes a zombie.
And what one, too, that a couple of these actually fall into place with, it's a vampire movie, but it's everything here pretty much happens, is From Dusk Till Dawn.
Oh, totally, totally. You know? Or even in Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah.
Even Shaun of the Dead with his mother and, yeah. like, I mean, all of that. Yeah, I mean, it's very, it is a cliche, but it always works really well to kind of show that same. And I think it harkens back to what I was really originally talking about with that Freudian idea of the uncanny, the same thing of, like, here's this person that you know and love, and they're becoming this monster. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I think that hits the terror at home even better than anything else. And so it's right. definitely a commonly used one.
Since I took one of yours, do you want me to do my number three? Since
yeah,
I
why
don't you tie in?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right, my number three is, and like I said, this kind of ties in with the family member one sometimes. But it's the guy who gets bit but always keeps it hidden. At least for a little while.
Oh, that's such a good one! Why didn't I think of that? That's a fucking great one!
Classic.
No, you're totally right. Yeah, the guy who gets bit. And I mean, with the exception of 28 Days Later, which it's like the 10 to 15 seconds before they become one. Mm-hmm. For the most part, yeah, any other zombie movie, like you've got like maybe... Because the atypical zombie idea is that they have to die before they become one, and so it's almost more of a virus that eventually yeah. kills you, and then you become one. You're right, though. Yeah, they have the one bite, and they keep it hidden. And
yeah, they don't tell anybody, and then they eventually turn at the worst moment.
Did you ever see the remake of Dawn of the Dead?
Yeah.
With the Taye Diggs, isn't that who it is? Whose wife is bitten and he keeps it a secret.
I saw it in the theater. I can't remember.
But remember, she's the one that's pregnant and then she dies and there's the zombie baby that they have to kill. Oh, it's great.
I haven't seen
it. Oh, it's so great. I own it. I've watched it so many times.
I remember really liking it.
I really liked it. I thought it was fucking great, man. But no, that's a good one.
Did Zack Snyder do that? Is that right?
Yeah. Zack Snyder. Okay. All right, I'm going to switch around my three and my two. Here's one for you. The bad guy from the survivors, from the group of survivors, and there always is the group of survivors.
Oh, yeah.
The guy that you really fucking hate, right? The one that's either coming up with all the really shitty ideas and is talking all the shit and being a dickhead, or the one that's the super pussy that's like, why do we have to do that? And you just, he bugs you so bad through so much of it. What you hope happens to him, happens to him. And he gets eviscerated by the zombies at some point, where they like literally like at some point, and you know it when you watch it.
The guy with the attitude,
yeah. You're going to see his lungs.
Yeah,
that's what it comes down to. Is the guy with the attitude? You will see his spleen and his lungs because he's going to get ripped from his fucking hairline to his fucking toes. He's just wah! It's going to be everywhere. It's going to be the gnarliest fucking evisceration you've ever seen in your life.
Nice.
And 90% of the time, it happens. Right? I mean, even 28 Days Later, good example. Like, the major, at the end of it, you see him just get, like, fucking pulverized.
He's mauled, yeah.
By that same guy, by the one that they had chained up. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's my number two of the cliches, is that... And in that way, it's kind of nice, because the zombies kind of work for you for once, where you're like, ooh, you're gonna fucking get it. They're gonna leave you behind. Yeah. And sure enough, like, another great example is the sniveling boyfriend in Shaun of the Dead, where he gets pulled through the window and they just rip him to shreds. He's like, that's such a great one.
Oh, I love that movie. All right, my number two is this one. Actually pretty normal, pretty cliche.
Mm-hmm.
But it's trapping yourself inside a building. Yeah, everyone.
Right.
You have to eventually, I guess, because you can't get away from them. But
you board.
No matter what, it happens every single time.
They're all in one little place together for sure, and like it gets worse and worse.
Yeah, and it's just building up outside, and that kind of, you know, I mean, it's nothing exceptional as far as cliches go, but it does happen all the time.
Well, I think every zombie movie, it happens where they find the old farmhouse, or, you know, if you want to go with Dawn of the Dead, then you have the mall, or you have the building, and everybody's inside of it. And you're totally right. That's sort of like the... And, I wonder if it doesn't have some throwback to the idea of like World War II and the Nazis, of like boarding up the house and they're all trying to get you, kind of a thing. And you see cool versions of it too, with, you know, I mean, in that respect, even a movie like M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong, whatever his fucking name is, Signs is sort of like more of a zombie movie than it is outer space sci-fi movie. It's more of a zombie movie of them boarding up the windows and doors, and waiting for the end of the world, you know? Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of a nice, I like that for, if it's done well, you can really delve into the motivations of the characters
sure.
and the storylines that everybody has. And that actually leads to my number one, which is my number one, number fucking one zombie movie cliche. The group of survivors, their fears and prejudices are always more dangerous than the zombies. Every fucking time.
Nice. That's
right? Like, one. Their own, like, need for power or revenge or fear or prejudice or anything else always overrides the fear of the zombies. Once you get a group of survivors together,
they turn against each other.
They're worse
yeah.
than what they're trying to fight.
Well, it's like I was saying, the man versus man thing.
Exactly, you know? Yeah, exact same thing. Like, once in 28 days later, once they get to the army, they were worse off than if they would have stayed in Brennan Gleeson's apartment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are worse off. Even though they don't have food or water, they're worse fucking off.
Yep, good one.
Thank you.
Okay, my number one, I'm proud of this one. My number one is... Everyone with no training at all, doesn't matter who they are, is gifted with a weapon when it comes to killing zombies. They can
right.
shoot them from a mile away, or they can hack them to bits in perfect, you know.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Why isn't there a zombie movie that has a guy like me in it? Where, like, when I was in Little League, like, I would sit in the bullpen and pray to God that we got out before I had to go up and swing the bat. Because I'm that inept when it comes to any kind of physical activity. Like, yeah, watch me with a baseball bat try to kill zombies. Like,
ow.
No, go, run. I couldn't do it.
Where's the guy, like, at the end of Out of Sight where he's running up the stairs
and... Shoots himself in the fucking head. Yeah.
I want to see that in a zombie movie.
Thank you for reminding me of that amazing scene from Out of Sight. That's one of the greatest.
It's incredible.
Amazing. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, like if I had a gun or a bat.
The bike messenger goes on a rampage.
Yeah, becomes... He becomes a righteous badass out of nowhere. Which, you know, pushes our story along, but definitely does not harken back to the idea of reality in any way. You're absolutely right. Fucking great, man. Well, all right. Once again, I think we had one the same, and most of the cliches were its own thing. So,
cool.
So that
cliches out there.
that ends our zombie portion of the Halloween Film Festival.
Well, Halloween month.
Yeah. Halloween, yeah. Next week we will be doing
The Wicker Man.
The Wicker Man, which I don't remember who
that's
it was. That's
one I haven't seen.
So. Now. I don't remember who it was that said this, but apparently, and it's on the box for The Wicker Man.
Well, let's clarify, it's the old Wicker Man.
The old Wicker Man, not the remake, not
Nicolas Cage.
No. God, no. The proper one, the real one. Not that bullshit. On the box of the original, it does say, the Citizen Kane of horror movies. Now, that's... I'm not going to say it doesn't live up to that, but that might be a bit of a
I wasn't crazy about stretch, but, game, but
you know. Oh, okay. Well, you know it has that reputation though, but you know, I think that it's going to be really good, and I'm really interested to see what you have to say about it. Along with that, with The Wicker Man, we will be doing top 5 clichés of the sort of stranger in a strange land. The man in the new town that may or may not be against him, sort of idea. So that's a little vague, but once you hear how we get into it, I think everybody will understand it. So we're gonna do that, and should we move on?
This is our final installment of
Cinema Westival,
Film Westival.
You know what I meant.
We are going to review The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
You know what you are! Just a day, son of a bitch!
Awesome.
Oh,
yeah. All right, so Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. This is what year was it?
66.
1966. Directed by Sergio Leone. Leone, whatever. So we've got...
this is actually one of the ones I've never seen.
Really?
Yeah.
I hadn't seen it in a really long time.
This is kind of one of the main reasons I want to do the Western Film Festival is because... You know, this is just one of those that you hear about forever.
Over and over and over.
I get some shit for not seeing some of these great movies. But at the same time, sometimes they get so played out, you're just like, well, my expectations are so high. It's kind of like what you said, where I have to see a movie either when it comes out or like 2 years later. When the hype is down and you don't have expectations. Because expectations, at least for me, can make or break a movie.
Oh, it's totally true.
And so I guess I just never had the opportunity, or at least watching it all in one sitting. Now, let me start off by saying, did you notice the length of this movie? Because it's close to 3 hours.
You know what?
Yeah.
I won't lie. I kind of didn't.
You didn't? That's good, though.
I didn't notice it. I was captivated, and like I said, I had seen it before, and there were things that I remembered about it, but it had been a really long time. And as I've said many, many times, I thought I didn't like Westerns. Mm-hmm. And I am very, very wrong. I will recant all of that now, because this movie, God, man, this movie is a tour de force. It plays... with so many different themes.
Mm-hmm.
And every time that you think you have this movie figured out, it switches it up on you again. And it through the whole thing, and it has everything, man. It has some really good humor in it. It has a lot of really good morality tale in it. It has some incredible action in it. This movie had a budget. I mean, it is... war scenes in it are fucking phenomenal.
Oh, yeah.
And it has places in it, and I don't mean this story-wise, because story-wise I had to play out the entire thing, but as far as climaxes, it could have ended 3 or 4 times.
Oh, easily, yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. These big, intense, awesome climaxes, and then the movie keeps going, and you get new characters, and you get new things. And
one thing I think that really sticks out too here, which is kind of a Sergio Leone thing, where I've seen, you know, Once Upon a Time in the West and stuff like that.
Yeah,
is the cinematography is just amazing. I mean, he's really, I think one of his big things is close-ups and stuff like that. But you can tell. I think. That this is probably Quentin Tarantino's favorite movie.
I totally do. And my wife said that to me when it gets to the towards the very end of the cemetery scene.
There's so
that
many,
was when she was just like, "Oh my god, this has to be one of his favorites."
There's so many Tarantino-esque elements in this movie that I guarantee he will admit saying, "Oh." Yeah,
I totally ripped that off. Yeah,
or just the Man with No Name movies.
Yeah,
sure.
That because this is one of the saga of the Man with No Name, along with Hang 'Em High, along with for a few dollars more, Fistful of Dollars. All of these films have Clint Eastwood as this character, no-name character.
Even down to the music, though.
Oh, yeah. No, I totally agree. So. Well, I think that... God, maybe this is a little controversial to say this. While I really liked Clint Eastwood in this movie, he is incidental to a lot of things that happen in it. I don't know the actor's name, the one that plays Ugly Tuco.
Tuco.
Eli Wallach.
That's what I got, yeah.
He is this movie.
Oh, totally.
I mean, his character
His character
embodies all of the spirit and weakness of your classic tragic character.
Well, and you go into this movie thinking this is a Clint Eastwood movie.
Yeah. He's wonderful in it.
He's one of the ultimate badasses of all time in cinema, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, yeah.
Tuco
steals the fucking movie.
He's so. You just go, like, he's such a prick, and you go through this emotional roller coaster with him.
Yeah.
Through so much and so many moods, and the camera stays on him most of the movie.
Yeah.
And he is slimy, and he is a rat. But you also want to see what happens.
All that stuff with his brother and the monastery, and you just amazing. And then him lying about it when he comes out, and you see that relationship between him and Eastwood, where they've hated each other because they were these con men together, and they totally fucked each other over, and now they're both on this path to find this money, this cash box that's at this cemetery. And once again, I'm fucking say it every time. Once again, I hate doing the diatribe, but I have to do it.
Yeah.
Go see the good, the bad, and the fucking ugly, because my God, people. My God!
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So, you know, so they're now even again. I mean, and all that cat and mouse stuff in the beginning between the two of them is great, because, you know, you realize that they're partners, and well, they're these con men, and it's so well done.
I really didn't see that coming.
I didn't at all.
And then, of course, you know, he's pissed at him because he leaves him in the fucking middle of the desert. And then it's funny, like, as soon as he finds out about $200,000, his mood, he completely changes.
Yeah, he's good to go.
He's like, well, all right, well, we've got some beef, but whatever.
I almost left you for dead in the desert also, but now we're buddies again. Well, and all of that stuff, I mean, just with Eastwood cleaning his gun and the guys are sneaking up, and all of a sudden the army stops in the middle of the road, and so it's dead quiet.
That's right.
And they're outside the door. And it reminded me of No Country for Old Men, right? Like the noise, and all of a sudden it's quiet. There's the hallway. And they're sitting there.
Your spurs gave you away, or whatever.
Oh, it's so good. But yeah, and so then, but see, all of that's just foreplay.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what does any of this have to do with Angel Eyes? Because Angel Eyes, who is? Oh. Oh, so we have the good, the bad, and the ugly. Clint Eastwood is the good. Tuco and in this movie, his name is Blondie.
Mm-hmm.
Tuco is the ugly. And, you know, he's the rat.
The other guy is Angel Eyes. Lee Van Cleef is his name.
Lee Van Cleef. That guy is a raging badass. So terrifying.
That first scene that we get of him, unreal, where he goes in. It's like the first 10 minutes with no dialogue.
No dialogue. And he's sitting and just eating across from the guy that he's about to kill.
Now, I would say probably the only weak point that kind of took me out of the story and the element of this whole movie... and it's unfortunate because they, like you said, they probably did have a budget, and I don't know why they did this, but everybody except for the three main characters
is dubbed.
Yes.
Yes. Their voices are all
driving me nuts.
Me too. It drove me fucking totally insane. And I mean, forgivable because it's an older movie.
It is.
Totally forgivable, but still pulls you out of it over and over again.
And you can tell these people are speaking probably their natural own dialect or whatever it is, and you just have them, they don't even match close sometimes.
No,
and
because the voices that come onto it, they're dubbed, sound like this.
Yeah.
That's like so painfully obvious, not them. Yeah. But still, I mean, that minor.
It is forgivable because it's such a terrific movie.
Agreed, yeah.
But it did pull me out for the scenes. But the thing is, the main story revolves about those three, and those are the, you know, it's all just the side people, most of it.
Right.
You know? But, man, what a just ultimate...
You know, and Angel Eyes, so terrifying of a bad guy. And one of these things where you just... And in a funny way, once again, sort of like No Country for Old Men, where you see both Tuco and then also Clint Eastwood's character, kind of, even though Tuco knows Angel Eyes... not ready to deal with a guy on that level. Because Tuco's an amazing gunfighter.
Mm-hmm.
He proved that already.
But he's still
kind of goofy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still like, yeah, like he's in the bathtub. And yeah, he's got his gun in the bathtub. It's amazing.
Best line of the movie, too.
Oh, what is it that he says? Oh, I know. I haven't written down, too.
If you're going to shoot, don't talk.
Yeah, don't talk, shoot. So yeah, fuck, awesome. Man. I'll tell you what, all the villains in any fucking James Bond movie could take a fucking note from Tuco on that one. If you're going to shoot, don't talk. What are you doing? But he's kind of a lovable character in a way, even though he's done bad things, that you just go, you're not ready to deal with a badass on the level of Angel Eyes. Like, he is
a fucking gnarly
dude. But Clint Eastwood's character, I think, is a severe badass, but you don't get that through a lot of the movie. He seems like he's kind of making mistakes, and like he keeps getting caught by Tuco over and over again, you know?
Yeah.
And you kind of don't see a lot of that, but then, you know, this movie unravels itself in these layers and layers, and every time that you think that you have it pegged of where the story is going to go, you get a little bit more. And I think the scene where Tuco deals with his brother and Eastwood hears it, and then they leave together, and Tuco's talking that brother of mine, he loves me so much, blah, blah, blah. And they had it out. I mean, and Tuco was gone when his parents died, and, you know, it was a really heartbreaking scene. And then they leave, and, man, Eastwood, just the man of all men, like, lights that cigar and just hands it to him.
Sharing cigars. These people don't care about germs.
No, well, there's a bonding. There's a really interesting bonding there between him and Tuco.
Yeah.
That's so interesting because you think they're on the same page, and then one of them fucks the other one over, and then they're on the same page again, and then another one fucks the other one over. And it keeps flip-flopping that way. But God, man, it is...
The cigars actually kind of play a pretty big role in this movie. Obviously, it's a trademark for Eastwood's character, of course.
Yeah, that little cigar in the corner of his mouth.
But it's also, you know, Tuco uses it as a way of trailing him through the desert, you know, when he's trying to find him, when he pops up in the window or whatever.
And, you know, you're absolutely right.
He picks it up and he puffs it to see how close he is.
Yeah, you know? Which I love. Yeah,
so cool.
And I didn't even notice it. My wife made comment about that on the very last cigar, and he puffs it and he's got a lot out of it. And she said, oh, he's real close. Yeah. And I went, yeah, you're right. He is. Huh? Totally. Because, like, he can still stoke it. You know, I have to say that through this whole film festival that we've been doing, none of our movies have linked up, really. From our main movie to our Western that we've done, this one does in two big ways. The first one is both 28 Days Later and this film have somebody getting their eyes gouged out by a dude with his thumbs.
That's true.
Right? When the guy muscles Tuco and almost pokes his fucking eyes out with his thumbs. Yeah. That. And then secondly, our movie's bebopping along doing its own thing until they meet up with the military. And once they meet up with the military, we get the sort of, like you said, Apocalypse Now commentary on, like, wow, we're in the middle of a war and there's some bullshit going on when they're dealing with them fighting over the bridge.
And we get that
great new character of the captain.
The drunk captain.
The drunk captain who's like, I just want to blow up the bridge. Fuck this place. Fuck these guys. I want to get out of here. I've dreamed about it. And then after that, he gets shot and they bring him in. And Eastwood, and this is where you start to see Eastwood's heart. Before this, he's kind of been this background character. He hasn't had a lot to do with anything other than, you know, he wants the money and you know that he was a partner of Tuco's. Other than that, you don't really know anything about him.
Mm-hmm.
Other than this scene, this is when it starts, and it starts to unfold to his own personal morals, is that he gives the captain some of the liquor to drink and says, Keep your ears open. We're going to make your dreams come true.
Mm-hmm.
Then they go down, they blow it up, and the captain smiles and starts laughing and then dies. And it's so good. It's so good the way that plays out. It's such a great scene, man.
A couple impractical things that I just thought would be funny to mention. Apparently, the Old West, especially in this movie, when they're walking through the desert constantly and... you know, obviously, town to town, that type of stuff. Nobody has short sleeves on. No, they don't.
They're wearing
ponchos and trench coats, and it's like 100 fucking degrees outside.
Well, and I think that does have something to do with just keeping the sun off of you, you know.
That's true, you know. And then they go through those scenes, and their face is all blistered.
Oh,
and stuff.
God, and oh, dude, the gross. Makeup's done really well. Honestly, the makeup of them having been in the sun looks really great.
The one thing, probably the most crazy part in the movie that I didn't see coming at all. Well, I guess I did. I just didn't expect it to be so brutal as it was. But when Tuco kills Wallace, when they jump off the train and he has to get the handcuffs off.
Oh, yeah. Dude, that is the most fucking amazing scene. Thank you for bringing that up.
He bashes his head against the rock, which shows quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, it is. Just like, whoa, shit. Fuck, man.
And then he throws him on the train tracks.
Yeah.
To cut the...
And the train drags the dude. Dude, it is brutal. It's so gnarly.
I was like, holy shit.
I couldn't believe it. That was so fucking rad. I mean, that kind of let you know that, like, he isn't fucking around. Well, and even I'll even go back to a scene right before that. When they have the first of all, the gimmick with when they're leaving the monastery and they think that they're gray coats that are coming towards them.
That's right.
And
that's
they're like, right. Oh, hey, the sounds are again. Yeah. And then they're like, they're dusty. That was a great gimmick. But then after that, in the prison camp, where they're just beating the ever living shit out of Tuco, and the band is playing.
That's right.
Oh, wow. You know, and that, I'll tell you right now, keep that. Okay, once again, we did with High Noon, where the song seems silly but becomes subversive.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie did the same thing, right? Where the song that they're playing, like, to what's going on is kind of fucked up. And I said before, keep that in mind for when we watch Wicker Man.
Okay.
Keep that same idea in mind, because it's the same thing of playing the sweet, kind of cutesy song against what we're watching. Well, you know what I mean?
They actually say it in the movie, saying, you know, he's going to beat him as long as the song goes.
As long
going.
As the song goes. And the one violin player can't play anymore, and he's like, more feeling.
Yeah.
Oh, so good.
And they're like, you know, we've all been in that room before with Angel Eyes. And
God.
Huge amount of depth.
The other part that just had my jaw on the fucking floor is once they get to the cemetery, once Tuco gets to that cemetery, and the cannon, he shoots the cannon, and it lands, and Tuco falls off the horse and rolls up and hits his head against the headstone, and then turns around, and the fucking cemetery is the size of a football field.
What a great shot.
Oh my God, amazing shot.
Well, and you know, they're obviously looking for a particular
grave.
And there's a, you know,
everywhere. Well, and the way the camera's spinning around the graves, and it's done so well. But even the scene right before that, where they come up on the soldier that's dying, and you get another little bit of Eastwood's heart, you know, where he puts his jacket over the kid.
That's
and
right.
Gives him a bit of his cigar, and he's sharing the cigar with him while the kid dies. Just amazing. This movie is really an anti-war movie in a lot of ways. Like, it really shows the unnecessary deaths. But that great line that Eastwood says when they're storming the they're watching the soldiers storming the bridge. He said, "That's the worst waste of men I've ever seen."
That's right.
You know, and it's just another one of those, like, wow, really anti-war, really making a statement.
You know, you see, you keep talking about Eastwood's heart, but. Which he obviously has a ton of it, but even up till the very last minute of the movie,
he's calculated.
He's messing with Tuco, you know.
Yeah,
I was actually kind of surprised how Tuco gives in so easily to step on the cross and put his neck in there.
Yeah,
but you know, he's still messing with him.
He's still the smartest guy in the room.
Exactly.
Even after everything's said and done, and that's the reason why he's the good is because. He knows who Tuco is, and he knows he's going to fuck him over at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has to go through, he has to play these things out. And you know it. You know he's going to shoot him off the noose. Mm-hmm. You know these things are going to happen, but
they just leave it up in the air. That
kind of.
I kind of wish that, but.
Kind of, but I got to like Tuco too much.
Mm-hmm.
I liked him so fucking much by the end of this movie. He carries the whole thing. Little moments where he's where they're watching him storm the bridge, and he's like, and they're talking, and they're both smoking the cigars, and then all of a sudden Eastwood notices that they're right in front of the box of explosives, and then you see Tuco's reaction to looking at the box, and he's like, oh, and it's just all of his reactions, everything about it's done so well. Eastwood's line after everything, there's two kinds of people, those with loaded guns and those who dig.
That's ultimate line.
So good.
As far as I know, Wild Bunch was your favorite out of all these. After watching this a second time, does that hold up to Wild Bunch for you? Or
oh yeah,
it does.
It really does. And I think if I had to go in order, and I these are classics, so I hate to do this to them, but if I had to, I would say I would say I've got a tie now between Good, the Bad, and the Ugly and the Wild Bunch. And then right behind it, I have a tie between High Noon and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. And then I'm putting Butch Cassidy behind that. Not to say it's the worst, but like of the five we watched, I would put Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid as the last. Probably then High Noon and right alongside it, maybe a little before it, Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. But then it's got to be a dead tie for me between Good, the Bad, the Ugly.
Yeah,
and the
I would say if I had to pick, it'd probably be Good, Bad, the Ugly, just because it's more my kind of movie.
Yeah.
I think Wild Bunch was definitely more of a surprise than anything as far as how incredible it was.
Yeah.
And how brutal and ruthless it was.
Definitely.
But, you know, it, just personal taste, I would say that. But I would almost put High Noon above Man Who Shot Liberty Valance,
really,
too.
Really?
I really just... more. That's kind of one of those that's just really... the more you think about... I mean, there's a reason why Man Who Shot Liberty Valance was made.
Well, and you know what was the main thing that I noticed, really, at the end of the day, after doing these Western movies, all five of them, the thing that I realized about the Western movie is that... and I think I really started thinking about it with... Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, because it dealt so much with the army of the North and the South. And you think about when these movies are supposed to take place, this is during a period of time when America is divided and there's an actual war going on inside of the country. And that these movies, at their heart, are about every man for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is about, I'm me, I don't give a fuck about anybody, I've got money I could grab, I'm going to do
even
it.
Even when you have a group of people like in the Wild Bunch, they're all...
they're all doing the same thing. Yeah. And then there is this undercurrent, this surge of undercurrent, and it kind of even works in with the 28 Days Later, the idea of the apocalyptic zombie movie, no law, total anarchy, that the human soul and the idea of empathy and the human spirit still at some point... emerges and has to take over everything else. It fucking has to.
Mm-hmm.
And that all of these movies are about that struggle between I can't rely upon anybody else and the law is gone and so it's me.
Mm-hmm.
But is the money more important than my soul? And every one of these movies seems to deal with that ideology.
Definitely.
And some of them deal with it better than others.
Well,
but...
and High Noon didn't really even have anything to do with money either.
No, it had to do with only...
the soul.
Right, yeah. Right and wrong. The soul.
That's
what,
right.
What, and the difference between what I think is right and what somebody else thinks
I guess
is
Man
right.
Who Shot Liberty Valance didn't really have money as well, so...
It had to do with law. It had to do with the soul.
Yeah.
Ethics.
And I
think that that's such a... and it makes me want to just go... it makes me want in, I don't know, maybe 6 months or something to do another one of these Western film festivals and
do
another five.
Yeah.
Because I'm so fascinated with this ideology now because it seems to be such a prevalent thing, this idea of the human spirit versus total anarchy and what creates us, what helps to create who we really are
mm-hmm.
at the end of the day if there is no law, right?
Totally.
Kind of like what the therapist says in Donnie Darko, if the sky opened up, there would be no law. There would only be you and the people you love and what that matters, you know?
Exactly.
And I just, I don't know. So, not
no,
to wax philosophical,
no,
but, you know,
I
it
don't
definitely...
have anything nearly as intelligent as that to say. I'm really, you know, these film festivals are really an excuse, at least for me, to embrace movies that I don't, you know, that I don't know about or the classics.
Oh, fucking A,
like
man.
And
me too.
And I'm
definitely.
Really glad that we chose this one because it really... exposed me to a lot of stuff that I've been wanting to see.
No,
for
I've
a while.
Got I've got a fever for old movies now. I mean,
yeah.
I just it's really.
I'm glad we chose it.
I am too.
Well, next week we're going to continue our film festival aspect of, or segment of the show.
Right.
We're going to do a whole new thing. We're going to flip it around completely. We're going to do controversial
documentaries. And because of Halloween right upon us, and sort of this theme of that. We are going to start with, I don't remember what year.
Hell House.
Was it 2004, I believe.
Something like that, yeah.
Hell House, the documentary about the evangelical Christian...
haunted house.
Haunted houses. I don't know if you know about this movie or not, but you should go and watch it.
Very controversial.
Very controversial.
Yeah.
It is.
And there is some messed up stuff.
I
think we should maybe make a rule, too, with these documentaries... that we could do non-spoiler stuff. I mean, because there's really...
No, we can. And I think two big things. I think non-spoiler, and we need to focus more upon the way the movie made us feel and less upon our own personal politics.
Sure.
Because they are going to be controversial, and they, which means the majority of them are going to deal with politics or religion. And we all know from our parents that those are never good things to talk about at a party. And our podcast is always kind of like a party. So.
Or while you're drinking, yeah.
Yeah, either one. So we're going to straight... we're going to stray away from those topics, but deal more with the meat of the matter.
And I think we should also say up front, too, we are not doing any Michael Moore movies.
No. Yeah, this is a Michael Moore-less controversial documentary.
More or less?
More or less?
No, that wasn't that good. The other movies that we're going to do, I think we wrote them down. We're going to do For the Bible Tells Me So.
For the Bible Tells Me So.
Which we both are absolutely in love with. And yeah. I think more than anything, just to get the movie out there to say, watch
this movie. Yeah. Buy it for all of your relatives for Christmas.
Seriously. I can't wait to talk about that one. Then we have, we are going to do... Paradise Lost.
Paradise Lost.
The Robin Hood murders, the three kids.
Yeah.
Robin Hood Hills or... You know
something,
what,
yeah.
The it's Robin the murder Hood, of the three yeah. children. It's, talk about controversial.
No, that's a yeah.
Why We Fight.
That's right.
That's a political documentary that we're going to do. That one, very necessary, especially with elections coming up. And I think
that would be a good one
to match up with election week.
Definitely. And then our fifth one is going to be Standard Operating Procedures. The guy, it's the same documentary Eli Morse that did Fog of War.
Thin Blue Line.
So that's going to be a great one, too. So we're going to start off next week with Hell House.
And then we'll figure it out.
Put it in your queue, people, because you need to see this movie. It scared the sweet bejesus out of me, and I'm not lying. So go ahead and see Hell House. That's going to be our first episode of we don't have a cute name for it.
No.
Oh, well.
Controversial
documentaries. Do you want to go ahead and take a break real quick?
Yeah. Let's go ahead and listen to a song, and then we'll come right back and go ahead and do some feedback. The song we're going to listen to is from V Vast.
The song is called Moving My Happy, which sounds kind of perverted. Doesn't it?
Let's go move your happy right now.
Woo! We'll be right back. Well, you think there's something in the air when you go? It's my first love too. Well, you think that I was mistaken? Yeah, when you go, it's my first love too. We'll be right back. welcome back.
Okay, let's
do a little bit of listener feedback.
Yeah, let's get into it. We got a couple little quibbles.
Quibbles?
I don't know.
All right. Do you want to start this one?
Yeah.
Ryan Doman.
Ryan Doman, a good friend. Ryan Doman. He says, "Thanks for doing The Changeling, one of my childhood favorites. Scared the shit out of me.
The tub, the bouncy ball.
I have tons of nostalgia attached to it, but it also stands up besides that, and I'm glad that you discussed that. Unfortunately, you failed to discuss my favorite part of the whole movie, the amazing and beautiful sweater vest sports coat combo that George C. Scott is wearing through the whole movie. Plus, he has great hair in that movie. Very dapper man.
Very dapper. I'm a dapper damn man, damn it.
I guess I just... I thought it was a 70s movie. I guess it is an 80s movie, but
he just looks so good. You almost don't even want to say anything because you're like, it's George C. Scott.
It just fit everything. I didn't really notice
the sweater vest, you're absolutely right. Very nice. Now, he also said on a separate note, I realize how Paulcher and I ended up listening to the music that we do. I grew up watching The Changeling, The Thing, endless amounts of horror movies and action movies, particularly with Schwarzenegger, and violent, usually Italian westerns. As you both know, I'm a huge metalhead. Paulcher grew up watching John Hughes movies over and over, and he's a sissy emo boy.
Oh, wow, man. Ryan. Well, in my defense, not only is this a learning experience for the audience, it is for me as well. And you know, everyone's got those movies that they haven't seen, and that's part of the reason I try to expose that, because I like going into a review fresh on something that doesn't have the expectations like I thought. So, in my defense, that is. But, you know, there's definitely stuff that, you know, I'm sure I can name 5 movies right now that you haven't seen.
This is true. This is very true.
You need to see. And I'm sure I can name... Ryan hasn't seen The Wild Bunch. So, there you go.
Fuck you, Ryan. Anyway, now he sent us a second email that said that he knows that this is an older episode, but he skips around when he listens. So... he's talking about Apocalypse Now. He says, "Sherlock, your story of seeing this at the revamped Egyptian theater brought back a funny memory. I was there too. I can't remember, but I either saw you or your brother Blake. Anyway, I was there on a date. I fucking love this movie and I always had. And I was so terribly excited to see this one on the big screen for the first time I could hardly sleep that week. At the time, I was dating this ex-stripper."
Which is pretty interesting.
Yeah. And Ryan, just let me tell you right now, there's no such thing as an ex-stripper. There's just a stripper that doesn't strip anymore, my friend. But there's no such thing as an ex-stripper.
Beautiful.
It's like you're not a drunk anymore just because you don't drink. Not fucking true. Anyway, he says, "Hot as shit, but a broad who's emotional..." Broad.
Yeah.
It's like Marv. "Hot as shit, but a broad who's emotional and philosophical..." Well, didn't have much depth to it. "When the movie was over and we were walking to my car, she was confused and disturbed, to say the least. A few blocks later, I had to pull over and she threw up all over the street. It was awesome. Thank you, Ryan."
I think that's a good segue.
I think that constitutes as a story about a horror movie. Even though it wasn't a horror movie, it almost works.
That's what I was going to say. It's a great segue. For those of you who do want to be a part of our show and want to submit your own feedback to us and be, you know, record yourself, give us a story, we will put it on there. We are actually going to skip the film festival for the last week of October for the Halloween episode and play a couple submissions, hopefully more than we have now.
Yeah, so if you have submissions, please, 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 just if you have a Mac and you have GarageBand and you don't know how to use it, email us and I will give you a walkthrough. If you do know how to use it, go ahead and record a story about a horror movie that you saw, or even a review of a horror movie that you really like, and we will play it at the end of this month. Now, we have other comments. Mark Middlemas, when we were talking about doing a black and white film festival, sent us a couple of great comments about Night of the Demon and The Best Years of Our Lives. He says that we won't be disappointed. He also makes the comment of the Paul Newman movie.
I knew this too.
That Gavin and you couldn't remember the name of. The Hustler. That is the precursor to
Color
of Money. He says one of his, Mark Middleton says, one of his favorite movies of all time, Which is, that's a bold fucking statement, Mark. Oddly enough, it also has George C. Scott, who is remarkable and memorable as usual. Seriously, this is a movie for the two of you to review. So thank you for that, Mark. Then we have a wonderful comment from Keith Callister, who says that it was a great show this week. The Changeling is a movie that he hasn't seen since he was 15. He says, I may go out and watch it again so I can look for all the little details that you guys brought up, although I never really found it that scary. Which, you know, at this point...
It's really not. I mean, it's more
than... I broke this pen. Keith, you know, you don't seem to find very much scary because he also makes comment about The Ring in a minute. And I'm one of those guys that when I go in and I watch a scary movie, I own
it. Get into it.
I own it from the minute I start watching it. I just do. You and I saw The Ring together.
Yep.
I was high as a goddamn kite. I can say that on this because I don't think my employer listens to this. And I did pass my piss test, but my God, I was so high. And I remember that there was a couple of scenes where I was laughing my ass off because I was so terrified by what I had just seen. But that's me. I go into it going, I want this to work. I want to be scared, so I'm just going to be like, whoa, what's happening now? That's me. So anyway, he says,
if the movie's the right mood and it's the right atmosphere, it totally
can work.
Yeah, it definitely
Keith
can.
Says that his friends were terrified about the wheelchair and the entire night, while he found that to be the most ridiculous part of the movie.
I guess if you're 15, you know, that may be scary.
Now here's a great comment. I thought that we had, and I had talked to a couple of people, they said that we covered all of the cliches for the Haunted House movie. Keith brings up a fucking great one. For haunted house cliches, he can't think of a single haunted house movie that takes place in a single story home. Every haunted house ever has at least two stories and some wicked staircase somewhere. And he's fucking totally right. And that is a great comment. Always a staircase. Now,
do that later. Should we do that for the end of the month? He does give a submission here.
He gave a great submission about the movie The Ring.
Maybe one of us will actually do the voiceover for
one of us. One of us will reenact your experience, Keith, about watching the movie The Ring. Perfect. So we're gonna wait on that one. He says that he'll go out and rent The Wild Bunch and High Noon, as he has never seen them, but he apparently should. Goodbye, douchebags, Keith. You know,
beautiful.
That comment.
One of my favorite people.
Not the douchebag comment. But the other comment about going and renting those movies?
Highly suggested.
That's why I do the goddamn podcast.
Exactly.
That's why right there.
Keith, you're one of our favorite feedbackers.
Yes, thank you so much. So for all of the rest of you that are listening in and not writing in, goddamn it, you fucking sons of bitches, write in a damn podcast at gmail.com or just go to adamnpodcast.com and click on the email. Please give us some comments here. And if you have the accessibility to record it, send us in a submission.
You could be famous.
Yeah, you could be as famous as we are.
Yeah.
And look at me, top of the world!
Do you know who I am?
Yes, I run a local podcast and I'm amazing. As I cradle my artsy award in my hands. All right, that's it for this week. I'm Adam Sherlock.
I'm Adam Pulcher.
And this has been a damn podcast, episode 28.
Thank you very much for listening.
Next week, Wicker Man.
Okay.
Goodbye, bitches.